I have a couple comments I'd like to make on things you said and get your feedback.
Sure.
One is about arming both sides or opposing sides in one country and another. It reminds me of during the 80s when the U.S. was providing intelligence and funding to Iraq and Iran, and Kissinger was so out front saying, we hope they will kill each other off. So the goal of creating constant chaos and mutual genocide, I'm sorry it sounds like a simplistic, but it seems to me more reasonable than trying to keep up with all the acronyms. The other thing is that when you talked about it would make more sense to stop sending bombs, the practical thing is that the U.S. economy is dependent upon the manufacture and sale and provision of weapons and military IT to the entire globe. And as somebody, I think it was Nancy Murray, just posted a really good article recently about the end of the trade show in Palestine now, that the Israelis and the Americans have again shown the world what they have, and it's been tested on live targets. So line up and get your weapons.
It's actually, so let me start by that point. Actually, Israel's weapons are marketed that way. You know, they call them field-tested when they sell them. So the blood of Palestinian children is actually promoted as a good experiment for the weapons before it's used elsewhere. Let me answer the two points that you raised. Second one about the U.S. economy being reliant on military spending. There have been a few good analysis and reports about this. Actually, military jobs are the least profitable for the U.S. economy. For if you want to get the most bang for your buck, you don't spend it on military. We spend 59-60% of the discretionary spending of the U.S. Budget goes to military spending. And I will elaborate on that in a second. That money, how many jobs per $1 million you can get is the lowest from any sector, any other sector. So if you want to spend the money on green energy or agriculture or whatever you spend it on, it actually creates more jobs to spend it on other sectors instead of spending it on military sector. That said, people who make money, make billions of dollars out of the military spending, are powerful people. They spend a lot of money in Washington, D.C., and they can push the right buttons to decide where the money goes and where the money does not. So I think they are the ones who are benefiting. So it's not really about the U.S. economy in general. Let me give you a side note about the military spending, and this is for you to expand on later. There are different ways to count how much money we spend on military, like all aspects of military spending in the United States. One of them is the discretionary spending, which is around 60%. It adds up to, this is the official numbers from the U.S. government, it adds up to around $600 billion a year. But there are some deeper research, there is deeper research into how much money we spend on military in the U.S. that includes other numbers that are not included officially in the military spending, such as sustaining nuclear weapons is actually under the Department of Energy. Some of it is under like environmental issues. Sounds like, oh, we're spending more money to protect the environment. No, it's actually nuclear weapons. VA is not counted in. And, veterans who need assistance were not injured in a hurricane. They were injured because of wars and military decisions. And when you add that up and the military portion of our national loan, the portion of interest that we're paying on the loans, when you add it all up, it ends up being $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year. Almost every dollar that we give to the U.S. government goes to military spending. Almost. It's crazy when you think about it that way. Now, regarding your first question, what can you remind me the first question I actually had?
Mutual genocide, like
yeah.
Iran and
so, as I mentioned, my wife is Iranian, and my grandmother from my mother's side is of Iranian descent as well. So I've seen the picture from both sides. What you're referring to is the 8-year war between Iraq and Iran between 1980 and 1988. And that war, in that war, the U.S. had an official policy that most likely was coined by Martin Indyk, called mutual containment, dual containment. This is what they called Iraq and Iran, dual containment. So they wanted to contain both countries by letting them kill each other. And that was the policy, dual containment. How do you contain Iraq and Iran? You let them kill each other until they're done. Now, this is not what's going on in Syria. That was an evil policy, but it was a policy. What's going on between Iraq and Syria and the U.S. intervention there, there is no policy. There is pressure by, you know, weapons manufacturers to sell more weapons. There are knee-jerk reactions to things that happen on the ground that the administration thinks they are responding to. But there is no policy. It's not like there are some masterminds thinking, oh, let's fund the different sides and different parts of the... No, there isn't. They have no idea that they're doing that anyway. Like, they seriously have no idea. Like we meet with top officials. And they're not really aware of this. They're like, oh, yeah, there is an apparent contradiction. No, it's not apparent. It's a disaster. It's a contradiction. It's not an apparent contradiction. You're funding the same, you know, people who are you're killing on the other side of the border, you know? And this happens in the U.S. in many other occasions, you know. The other example I want to give is the PKK, which is a party that was considered a terrorist party by Turkey and by the United States when they fight in Turkey. But then when they cross back to Iraq, they had a headquarters and they were funded by U.S. allies in Iraq. So it happens, not because of, you know, some shrewd politician putting a plan to control the world, but it's lack of comprehensive policies, lack of vision of engagement with the world.
Isn't the policy to attack and destroy all the enemies of Israel, starting with Iraq, Syria, Iran? I mean, isn't that what it's about?
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, you know, certainly AIPAC has been pushing for the war with Iran. You know, Martin Indyk, I mean, he's, you know, you can't talk about a more dedicated supporter of Israel than Martin Indyk.
Correct.
Who is that?
Martin Indyk, he's the former U.S. ambassador to Israel, and I think he was... he's linked with, he's a huge spokesperson of Israel in Washington, D.C. I think he's like a cheerleader of Israel. He was involved with the negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians lately, but I think he just quit. The answer to your question is yes. When you look at the larger picture of who the U.S. Got involved with and wasted our blood and treasure on, it wasn't strategic enemies of the United States, really. There were strategic enemies of Israel. There were obstacles in Israeli control over the region destruction of Palestinians. But the U.S. was never in direct strategic confrontation with Iraq. One of the examples that I always give is that until 1990, you know, the U.S. and Iraq were allies.
Yes.
We had an automobile factory in Baghdad. So Iraq was manufacturing U.S. cars in Baghdad. And the automobile factory that Iraq bought for $1 billion was bombed by U.S. airplanes less than a year after it was manufactured in Iraq. But, I mean, you see, like, the two countries, you know, they had some differences in their approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, definitely. But the U.S. and Iraq, I don't think there was any justification for us to send millions of our troops you know, 3,000, more than 3,000 of them were killed, tens of thousands injured. We wasted $3 trillion of taxpayers' money. There is no justification to do that in Iraq from a U.S. perspective. But from an Israeli perspective, of course there is. They got rid of one of their worst enemies in the region.
The one justification I would point to would be oil. I mean, it's the second largest producer in the region. It used to have a nationalized oil company that's now, it's totally been exposed. When our troops went in, we all know the story about how they, you know, went and defended the oil industry, oil ministry and nothing else. They still fight with the oil workers, try to stop them from organizing.
Yeah, that was...
Now Exxon and all those people are there. That, to me, is even more important for some people in this country than Israel and whatever.
I agree. I mean, that's what I thought initially. But now when you look at who ended up signing oil contracts, the U.S. didn't really get that much. The U.S. used to get more Iraqi oil before 2003 than now. When you look at the sheer numbers, most of the contracts went to Chinese and British companies who are state-owned. And that's for a real reason. The reason is that the Bush administration tried to shove an oil law down the throat of Iraqis to privatize Iraq's oil and make the oil owned by international corporations. And then they will share the profits, you know. They'll make, out of every $100 per barrel, they'll make $30 or $40, you know. That oil law didn't go through, and now they make $1 per barrel when they work there. So companies who have interest in bringing more access of oil to the market, like China and state-owned companies who were not very interested in making money, but very interested in actually getting access to energy, they got the contracts. ExxonMobil and American companies had some contracts, but it wasn't worth the $3 trillion loss.
That was their goal.
So I'm aware of the time, and I think so. It's 5 minutes to 8:30. So what I will do? Let me ask a question. Is there an interest to stay for an additional 10 minutes?
Yes.
Wow.
We can go another half an hour.
Right? Half an hour. Okay. I can go as long as you guys want, but I just want to make sure we're not extending it too long for you. So let's take your question.
How long is it going to take for the United States to realize that supporting the worst elements in Israel is not in their interests? And how can we move that forward?
I mean that, you know, okay. I give like many funny and like rhetorical answers. This question, I seriously don't know the answer to it. I've been in Washington, D.C. for almost a decade. And I seriously cannot get why... How? Israel has this much power in D.C. I mean, in D.C. you can say anything. You can stand in the street and say, I don't believe in God. People will be like, eh. You can stand in the street and say, I hate Obama. I think Obama is a Kenyan who should be thrown out of this country. And people will be like, No one can say Israel without five disclaimers, though. It's like the only taboo on Washington and on Capitol Hill. And it's I seriously don't get how much power is there, how much leverage they have over congressional offices. I think the situation, once you get out of the official vote, is shifting. So among staffers, for example, especially younger staffers, they're not repeating the party line. And I think they try to challenge their bosses. I think even Congress members themselves are complaining. I'm sure you all saw the moment when Kerry said that on TV. He's like, Israel, defend itself. And then when he thought the camera was off, he said, what the hell of a pinpoint operation. Because that's what he actually believes in.
Yeah.
He thinks this is not a pinpoint operation. He thinks it's a mess. Yeah. He thinks that Israel is a liability on him. That they're making him defend something that he doesn't believe in. But he can't say it publicly. So I think there is a shift in attitude. I have seen a larger shift in the State Department and in the White House than the shift among Congress members. But there is a shift. It's a very slow shift, but it's happening.
Do you lend any credence to some of the internet reports that the Gaza invasion had something to do with Gaza reserves of oil and natural gas?
I mean, yeah, I think the natural gas issue in Gaza is a very interesting issue. I don't think it's an immediate cause for invasions. I think the larger picture includes controlling all land, all resources, whether it's water or gas or land, anything that has to do with the territory there, air, you know, anything. So, I mean, definitely controlling the sea and the gas is one of the main goals, like taking it away from the people in the Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, Israel's use of underground water is completely unfair and illegal in many occasions, not only with Palestinians, but with neighboring countries, with Syria and Jordan. Israel's use of fishing for Gaza, it's completely illegal. So it is about the total domination of resources and land there.
When I look at what we have done over there, it seems like, in terms of action, our action seems to have been, the United States government action, excuse me, has seemed to be oriented toward destroying as much of the economies in the Middle East, damaging the people, just generally doing as much as can be done to weaken and drive backwards and fragment the region. I assume that if this is a rational, thought-out policy, it must be because they think that makes it easier to dominate or control a region. And we already went over what we did in the Iran-Iraq war. Then we continue it with, in 1990, the Bush administration, when it bombs Iraq the first time, it bombs the water system, the health system, the electrical system.
Like what Israel did this week.
And then under a humanitarian UN operation, we prevent them from getting chlorine to purify drinking water for 8 years, killing another million old people and children and so on. And so it seems like possibly we're just continuing the same strategy. In other words, I'm suggesting that what you're saying is incoherence, craziness. They don't know what they're doing. Well, maybe they do know what they're doing. Maybe they're just continuing doing the same thing, deliberately funding whoever they feel like at any moment in time to perpetuate conflicts, maximize destruction in every way possible. And now in the case of what you're saying, the Biden plan, fine, you know. I mean, we obviously bankrolled ISIS in Syria and made them the most effective fighting force for some period of time over there. Then we claim that we stopped funding them and all that. But very convenient. Either directly or through Saudi Arabia, we could be funding them in Iraq. You yourself said, well, here we go. Now, here's the to succeed in the breakup of Iraq. Mm-hmm. You know, we put ISIS in there to try and foment the Sunnis for independence.
Let me say something. I mean, I'll build up on a point that was made earlier, which is, I think, for the U.S. as a capitalist country with companies that wants to sell products to people, it actually doesn't make so much sense for a capitalist system to destroy markets. At the end of the day, they want to sell things. So they don't really want people to manufacture things that much. They would like them to all sit in cities and order from Amazon. But that's not happening. So I think what happened is was a strategic victory for Israel because it destroyed all of its enemies. It was a strategic victory for Israel because now Israelis go in demonstrations saying, what about the 100,000 Syrians that were killed? How come you're not... So they create even more bloody and scary examples that Israeli crimes seem like very reasonable in their... And more importantly, it turns the region into a region of nation states that are ethnic based. And Israel will say, see, we're not the only Jewish state, that's a Shiite state, and this is a Sunni state, and that's a Christian state, and that's a Kurdish state. Why don't we have our Jewish state? Because they were an exception, and now they're becoming just a part of the rule. So when you look at it, all what happened actually feeds into Israel's strategic narrative of the region and itself. It doesn't really help the U.S. though. I think the U.S. would have been more interested in having an automobile factory in Baghdad and selling GM cars there with bad switches and stuff to Iraqis. I mean, that's better from an American perspective, but that's not good from an Israeli perspective.
Reflections that also
have
your comment on. Someone asked about, you know, why now? Why now for the massacre in Gaza? And there was a really interesting show on with Norman Finkelstein, I can't remember the other person, at Democracy Now! A couple of Fridays ago, where they were arguing that it was because to defeat the Hamas, the unity deal, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was just one thought that it was a really interesting show. And the other question I have is that I think also it was Democracy Now! A couple of days ago had a where they were discussing, I think it was with the UN, some UN folks about the world, is it the World Court, or basically bringing
International Criminal Court
to...
The ICC, the International Criminal Court.
Right, yeah. Right, and that there's more likelihood, or that that might be able to happen now because Palestine has some statehood status.
Correct.
In certain circumstances in the UN. Yeah. So I just wanted to kind of get your perspective on both of those.
That's a very good point, actually. So when I was in the East Jerusalem, that's what every single person told me when I was there. Every single person, like whether it's like a taxi driver or someone at the pharmacy or someone who I run into down the street, and I have a chat with them, and they say, this is happening because of the Palestinian Unity Government, you know? That's what they tell me. They're like, once the Palestinian Unity Government was announced, everyone was saying, just wait for a few days, Israel will come up with some false flag attack, and they will come after us and destroy us. Everyone was saying that. Everyone was anticipating it. So I don't think it's a coincidence that it happened after that. The issue about the ICC, it's a very important issue. I've been following it very closely. So the International Criminal Court has jurisdictions only over countries that are members of the treaty. So you have to actually be a signatory for the ICC to have jurisdictions over what you do.
And
doesn't make sense.
State also, so like
sorry?
if you're a non-state, if you're living in a non-state.
Yeah. So both Israel and Palestine are not signatories to the ICC yet. The U.S. is not, for the obvious reason. I mean, it's such a convenient thing. Seriously, imagine if our society had a court system that you have to sign up to be a member under that court system. And all gangsters will not sign up, you know? No murderers will ever go sign up, you know? So what's happening with the ICC is that Palestine applied for to have jurisdiction, for the ICC to have jurisdiction. They said, you're not really a state. A couple of years ago, Palestine was recognized as a non-member state of the United Nations General Assembly, and it passed by an overwhelming vote of the world, except for, of course, the US and Israel and the three countries who do this all the time. Now there is a discussion whether ICC will have jurisdiction or not. The other way to get the ICC to have jurisdiction is for the Security Council to refer the matter to the ICC, and of course the US will yet again veto what almost every country in the world wants to have. Now, let me expand on that, because no one asked me about the Leahy Law.
Oh.
So I have to ask myself about it. So at the Leahy Law. So at the same time that we have these, so the ICC is based on mostly on international treaties. If there is a grave violation of the Geneva Conventions or their protocols or the international humanitarian law or like any other international conventions, that ICC will look into it. Now, that might happen and we should support it. At the same time, we have some mechanisms inside the United States that we can try to invoke. U.S. citizens can push for it. And these are that we have two main mechanisms that we can actually push for cutting weapons that are going to Israel. The first one, it's a little bit hard to achieve. It's called the Arms Control Act. The Arms Control Act prohibits the United States from giving assistance or selling weapons to any government that has been involved in gross violations of human rights or committing war crimes, etc. Now, we know that Israel has been doing these things. The U.S. will not cut its funding from Israel anytime soon. It's not going to happen because of the political realities in D.C. No one will vote on cutting that. Now, the second thing that AFSC has been exploring, and I hope each of you will research it and think about it and talk about it with other community members. It is the Leahy Law. It's named after Senator Leahy from Vermont.
Good man.
He's a good guy, usually. you know, there's this abbreviation that was invented a few years ago. It's PEP, P-E-P. It's progressive, except on Palestine. So we have so many pips in the community. So yeah, people who are like up in arms about dolphins who are dying, or like, you know, some violation. But when it comes to Palestine, they're pretty quiet. The Leahy Law is really important, and I've been working on it. I've been working on it for years, and now we're actually taking a few steps forward. What the Leahy Law does is that it requires the United States to stop funding one soldier or one unit that has been accused of human rights violations. So we don't have to cut our military funding to Israel. We don't have to change the numbers that we're sending them. We don't have to take anyone to court. We don't have to do anything. All what we'll do is that there's this one Israeli unit, one, that has killed a child. In a very clear violation of human rights, if this violation was documented by a human rights organization, by a credible source, the U.S. has to say, Israel, you can't give our weapons to unit number 520 because this unit has committed one human rights abuse. Now, believe it or not, with all of the human rights abuses that Israel have done, not a single Israeli soldier has been blacklisted. Not one. Not one Israeli soldier.
Surprise, surprise.
So, we have to push for it. And what we found out after years of research and pushing, just a couple of weeks ago, we found out that the U.S. actually has no mechanism to track U.S. assistance to Israel. We don't employ any mechanism. So we have mechanisms to track where our weapons go to any other country in the world. That's why, for example, some units in the Nigerian forces, Nigerian armed forces, are blacklisted under the Leahy Law. We can't work with them because they have committed human rights abuses. That's why many other, you know, there are hundreds of units who are blocked. There are hundreds of thousands of units who are vetted every year. Not one Israeli unit. So I think this is a very useful tool. There is enough political appetite in D.C. to push for it. It's the law. It's not, we're not pushing for a law. We're pushing for implementing a law. So I hope you'll have time to look up the Leahy Law, see its implementation, and try to speak to your Congress members about applying it to Israel. You know, there are many reports by HRW, by Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, documenting grave, huge violations against human rights. We have names of units who committed these crimes and names of victims. I'll take one more question.
If I could just get a second.
Okay.
On behalf of Veterans of Peace, I'd like to thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
And informing people and keeping them knowledgeable. I'm going to give you this little dedicated
Thank you so much for
this. We are the only veterans organization that is totally for abolishment of war.
Thank you so much. I'm a big supporter of
yours is newer to mine.
Because that wasn't a question, I'll take a question. One last question. Last question.
I apologize to those who've been in meetings with me and heard me say this, but Steve Waltz, who wrote the co-wrote the book, The Israeli Lobby, has said in a talk this year, actually, last spring, that one of the reasons why the Israeli lobby is so powerful and has gotten away with what it's done is because it's been pushing on an open door. That although J Street has mounted an effort to push back, basically, all of us, and I'm talking to the choir because I know there's some people who have been working this for decades, longer than I have been, but I don't think people have, some people have said, it's impossible to fight that, and have sort of had a self-defeatist attitude and haven't organized strategically enough to actually mount an effort. This man sent around a video this week showing one of the bills and how it passed the House unanimously. And the bill, the man reading the bill, read the bill, and the vote was called. And one woman said aye. It sounded like one man also said aye. Nobody said nay, and it passed the House unanimously.
Correct.
I think the Senate, yeah. The time is right now that if we are strategic and if we are organized, and there's UJP, and there's peace action, and there's mass peace action, and there's JPP, and there's so many groups right now, that if people, I don't think we can take to the streets, that's some of the action, but there's also political action. I think that now is the moment that if enough of us say, okay, we're going to put in X amount of time every week on this, and we contact other people, that we may have a moment here where we can move things forward. What do you think?
Well, why aren't we chaining ourselves to the door at APAC? Other than out of Washington, just in groups, chain yourselves to the door.
On that note, I agree. I mean, I think we are actually at a moment where we can affect more change than usual, and the U.S. public opinion is shifting.
Yeah.
I think the question that we are asking ourselves in D.C. is what is the legislative, the policy vehicle that we want to use to put all of our effort and energy on it. That's why I mentioned the Leahy Law, because it's one of these vehicles that we haven't really explored before. I think it will be the biggest victory since any of us started organizing on these issues, if we can cut U.S. military aid from one Israeli soldier. One Israeli soldier. And I think it is achievable. I think the time might be coming for that. And that will change things. Once we start holding Israel accountable, things will change. I think accountability is the word. I think once we hold one Israeli soldier accountable, we can open the door to holding other Israeli soldiers accountable and other criminals in this country who have been compliant with their crimes as well. Let's end here. If you have more questions, I can chat with you after. Thank you so much for coming tonight.